This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
I'm a British Asian. I'm a Muslim. I was born in Chatham. I've lived in Gillingham my whole life. I very much see myself as British. I see this country as, you know, who I am, what I am. For me, this is my identity. But that I now feel is being questioned in a very real way. And we do have to decide at some point in our future what type of country we want to be. And I have seen, certainly on social media, I can show you how much abuse I receive. And some of the languages, you know, the racism, being called the P word, being said, told, you're not white, so you can never be British. Some incredibly misogynistic comments. I receive those on a daily basis on my social media. And I often share them because I think it's important to show what people are saying out there.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast.
In this week's episode, we hear how the Reform Civil War at County Hall has continued. Late requests for money have caused friction between two councils, and Canterbury City Council is ramping up parking fees yet again. I'm Daniel Weston, the local democracy reporter covering borough and district councils here in Kent, and I'm joined by Robert Boddy, who covers Medway Council.
Hello.
And Nikki White, who, in the absence of regular host Simon Finlay, will be looking at the latest goings on at County Hall.
Hello.
And also our special guest today is Gillingham and Raynham MP Nalshaba Khan. First up though, Rob, what have you been looking at of late?
Well, Simon's usual brief has crossed over into mine as Medway Council's Cabinet had to withdraw an item for discussion at its Cabinet meeting because of the leadership at Kent County Council. The item in question was an agreement between KCC and Medway to fund a replacement for Visit Kent and Locating Kent, which both went bust in September. The agreed plan, which was to be voted on at the Cabinet, was for Medway to contribute £50,000 and KCC £450,000 to pick up where the two organisations left off. However, just days before the Cabinet meeting and several days after the papers had been published, late on Friday, Medway Council was contacted by KCC's top team to ask to change the terms.
And what did KCC want out of them instead?
KCC wanted Medway to double its contribution to £100,000 and reduce its own to £400,000. At the Medway Cabinet meeting, members said they were not opposed to discussions around the terms, but last minute, when documents were already out and out of nowhere, isn't the way to do it. They also made clear this was not an officer decision and had been taken by the political leadership, who they said clearly lack an understanding of how local government works. The item was pulled and, after future discussions, will be back. But members said there was an urgency to pick up Locating Kent and Visit Kent as soon as possible to retain its data and other assets which could be lost.
Thanks very much, Robert. Nikki, another busy week at County Hall with Reform at each other's throats, I hear.
Oh, yes, it's been exactly that. And things have moved so fast, it's been difficult to keep up. But yes, the turmoil engulfing the Reform administration at KCC continues. And in the past week, five councillors have now been expelled from the party in the wake of that leaked video, which plunged its leadership into crisis. The latest dismissals came on Monday when Brian Black, Paul Thomas and Oliver Bradshaw were thrown out following the expulsions of Bill Barrett and Robert Ford 3 days earlier. It's been quick and decisive. Action, which Councillor Kim Caron had warned about. So within hours of the clip of her swearing and raising her voice during a virtual meeting over the summer was published, she vowed to track down the culprits. Now, initially, four members were suspended, Councillor Thomas, Councillor Bradshaw, Councillor Barrett and Councillor Maxine Fothergill, while an investigation was launched. Councillor Barrett, who strenuously denies leaking the footage, says he was shown the door on Friday for WhatsApp messages posted in a private group chat in which he called Deputy Chief Whip Councillor Wayne Chapman Darr. The party also cited Councillor Barrett's description of leadership communications as another reason for his departure, adding that his language was inflammatory and deliberately divisive. Now, he in turn hit back. He branded the leadership at County Hall as toxic, with both councillors claiming they were bullied. Now, Reform has said there's been no evidence of bullying in both cases. Councillor Barrett said he was aware of at least 8 formal complaints to Reform HQ over senior members' behaviour, but he said HQ has done nothing about it. He's the member for Ashford Rural South. He says he was sacked from his deputy cabinet member's post for transport on July the 7th, with the official line being it was by mutual agreement, but he disputes that quite strongly. Now, Councillor Ford was suspended on October the 13th for alleged unofficial complaints by female KCC staff members. He says no details were put to him about where, when and how he acted in the way it was claimed, but a senior party source says he actually failed to show up for a meeting when the allegations were to be discussed. Now, Councillor Ford believes it was more likely this action has been taken against him due to a strong strongly worded email he sent to other reform councillors expressing his concern about the leadership at KCC. It's worth pointing out he says he's now consulting lawyers over what's happened. Now, a Reform UK spokesman told us, and I quote, councillors Barrett and Ford have been expelled as their conduct undermined the interests of the party and brought Reform UK into disrepute. On allegations of bullying, a party source has said the party takes claims of bullying seriously, and if there was any credible evidence of this, we would not have hesitated to take action. So on Monday, we're up to Monday now, three more members were dismissed, with Councillor Black, Councillor Thomas and Councillor Bradshaw expelled following a meeting held at the request of Lindingham Caron. A short statement issued by Reform UK's London headquarters said a decision had been made to expel all three from the party after they displayed, and I quote, a lack of integrity. The statement went on to say that these individuals have shown a pattern of dishonest and deceptive behaviour which the party will not tolerate from its elected officials. Now, we did approach all three for comment. Councillors Bradshaw and Thomas declined to do so, and Councillor Black did not respond to our requests. Now, of all five of those council expelled, as well as Councillor Fothergill, who represents Seven Oaks Rural North East and remains suspended, they're now sitting as independent members. Now, as you can imagine, with all this going on, the opposition parties at County Hall have seized on this turmoil. We've had Green Councillor Stuart Jeffrey saying it's time for Councillor Kem Caron to go, while the Lib Dem Deputy Opposition Leader Councillor Richard Streatfield, he said the longer this goes on, the longer Kent's reputation will be dragged through the dirt. And as we'll talk about later, Councillor Kem Caron remains defiant. Speaking this week, she says she makes no apology for her approach and she doesn't feel she's done anything wrong.
So nice and quiet then. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
So Dan, what have you been up to this week?
So as is annual tradition by this point, I've been revisiting the topic of parking fees in Canterbury districts. Canterbury City Council has long come under fire for its parking charges, some of which are the priciest in the whole county, about £3.70 an hour in some of the car parks in Canterbury and Whitstable. However, in the budget for the 2026-27 financial year recently released, the authority has proposed to increase the rate yet again at the premium car parks.
How much by?
So it's only 10 pence an hour, so it'll be up to £3.80 in those, I think it's 9 car parks across the district. Prices in most of the car parks are going to stay exactly the same. But naturally, this has attracted the ire of business people in Whitstable in particular, which hosts three of these expensive off-street car parks. Small business people in Whitstable have told us that the increases of several years ago, where the current banding system was introduced and some car parks went up by over a quid an hour, did significant damage to footfall, and that customers complain about it very frequently and all that kind of thing. Naturally, the City Council administration has stressed that in real terms, the prices are actually frozen at most car parks because due to inflation, if they're not increasing, if real terms are slight decrease. And they've also been pretty unapologetic about the fact that their huge parking income is a big part of why they're in a pretty good financial position as far as it goes for local authorities.
So is this set in stone that it will increase?
Probably. I mean, they were planning to do the same increase of 10p up from 370 to 380 last year, but U-turned on it. I'd be very surprised if they did it again, even though there'll be probably some political pressure to do so.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to kentpoliticspodcast@thekmgroup.co.uk.
Nashaba Khan was one of the 11 Labour MPs elected in the 2024 election in Kent to her hometown seat of Gillingham and Rainham. She's no stranger to politics in the towns, having been Labour's candidate in the 2014 Rochester and Strood by-election, and then serving on Medway Council from 2015, first in opposition and then as a cabinet member for housing and property. Nashaba Khan, welcome.
Thanks, Robert. Great to be on here.
So you've been in Parliament now, you're elected in 2024, you've been there for about 15 months. Have you gotten used to the place and or are there things that still surprise you about it?
So I certainly feel a lot more used to it than I did when I first started. And I'd been in and around politics for a long time. But I think when you first become an MP and you experience the House of Commons and Parliament as an MP, it really is a bit of an eye-opener. And I think for me, one of the big things that I hadn't really realised, I mean, there are a couple of things, but one of the big things was just how much as an MP you are expected to sort of function a little bit like a small business. So in the very first early months, I had to set up my own office team, get an office. And there's some support for that, but it's very limited. And I don't think I've quite appreciated how much of it feels like setting up your own business whilst also not. And I think sometimes you think, most of my work will be learning how Parliament works and the protocols, which again is interesting. But I hadn't perhaps appreciated the other side of it as well. In terms of now, I certainly feel more settled. But it's interesting, isn't it? Because there are so many things that happen in this place that can probably, to the outsider, feel quite odd. And it's strange that after about 15 months, you just seem very used to it. Like, you can't refer to people by their name in the chamber. Everybody's your either your right honourable friend or the right honourable member for their constituency. And in normal life, that's just not how you speak to people. Mm. But you get very used to it quickly.
I mean, you mentioned there sort of setting up your team, and a lot of that is to do, of course, with working your constituency and supporting your residents and bringing up their issues in the Houses of Parliament, but also sort of out on the patch. What are the things that the constituents most consistently come to you about, and has that changed over time?
So certainly there are some reoccurring issues. I mean, obviously, my office and I deal with a real variety of concerns, but there are some things that certainly are reoccurring. And a few of them range from the quite big national issues to the hyperlocal. So, you know, healthcare comes up quite often, but then people often link that to their own personal experiences, either with GPs or with the hospital. We have big conversations around things such as housing, and from housing is one of my biggest caseloads, but for lots of reasons. And certainly in Gillingham, a lot of that conversation has been around the condition of some of the housing standards, but also what we've seen recently, which is an increase in the number of HMOs and how that's changing and shaping our communities. An issue that's sort of come up a lot at the start and certainly peaked very recently was around pharmacy issues in Raynham and specifically Jutes. And then I also have some big ticket items that people will discuss with me. Immigration does come up on the doorstep quite often. People are also speaking to me about some of the decisions that they see in government and what they think those impacts might be for them and what that means. And as I say, healthcare is probably the number one thing that we see a lot of.
As I mentioned in the introduction, you've mentioned just that housing is a big interest of yours, and you've been doing a lot of work around HMOs in Gillingham specifically. You wrote to Medway Council suggesting that they seek an Article 4 direction. Can you tell us a bit more about what the issue actually is for people who aren't aware, and how the mechanism that you suggested would help that situation?
Certainly. So HMOs, or houses of multiple occupancy, I think most people probably will know what they are, but just for clarity, it's when you often see, I guess the examples that we see in Gillingham are three-bedroom terraces, which would normally be seen as family homes, that are then converted into six- or eight-bedroom properties where, you know, six or eight to eight strangers could live, and they have a shared, they either have separate bathrooms or they have shared bathroom facilities. There's some slightly different ways that they work. We've seen a huge increase of those in particularly certain parts of Gillingham in recent years. Now, just for clarity, HMOs themselves, I mean, they exist in lots of parts of the country, and I used to live in one myself when I was a student, and there's lots of professionals as well, particularly in the city, who live in HMOs, because it's a really good way to be able to get accommodation, share with other people who perhaps are a similar age or similar backgrounds or doing similar work to you, and be able to afford to live in certain places. So there is a role for HMOs in our communities, and I just want to be really clear on that. But I think what we've seen happening in Gillingham is the number of those coming up very, very quickly. So in an area where housing was already quite low cost, and already quite sort of dense in terms of the number of properties that we have, what we're now seeing is a huge number of HMOs popping up. Some of them have to go through the planning system and get consent from the council. Others don't have to go through that process. And what that's doing is it's creating a sort of area where you've now got a predominant one type of housing, or the risk of predominantly having one type of housing. And with that, I think, comes some bigger challenges. First of all, around the lack of family accommodation, but also the fact that sometimes those HMOs can be used to house highly vulnerable people. And my concern with that is not to say that we shouldn't be supporting or housing people who are highly vulnerable, but to say that if you create a space where you just have so many people of a particular background or who have such high needs, you create issues within the community that just have to be dealt with. And it's sort of changing the face and shape of Gillingham, an area that I grew up in a way that I just don't think is right. So what I'm suggesting the council does is limits the number of HMOs within the particular area. And the Article 4 direction enables them to do that. It allows them to identify how many HMOs already exist, and then to be able to put some light, the ability then to sort of control and manage how many then come forward going in the future. And that just gives a little bit more control over something which at the minute just feels like it's getting a little bit out of hand. And so that's what my letter to the council is about. And that's something that I know that they're considering very, very carefully. I don't think it's going to solve everything. I think there needs to be a further look at how HMOs operate in our community, things like permitted development rights, how it means that often they can go unchecked, and also the standards that exist within them. And I know the council are already doing some work on that through their selective and additional licensing schemes. But it is an issue in Gillingham, and it's something that I'm really keen to try and, you know, housing's been my passion for a number of years, and I've been working within housing various sectors of it for a long, long time. And I do think you need to be really careful about maintaining that kind of mixed community need that you need in spaces like Gillingham. Otherwise, risks are great, I think.
Mm. I mean, you're also a member of the Housing Communities and Local Government Committee, so you take a very close look at all these issues. I mean, we hear all the time about there's a shortage of housing across the country. What is the government doing to build more homes or make houses more affordable, or what is the government doing on that?
So first of all, unfortunately, I'm not on the committee any longer. I had to stand down because I was to take up my PPS role in the Cabinet Office. But it was a committee that I really enjoyed serving on, and I've only stood down from it this week. But of course, housing remains my passion, something that I'm going to continue to talk about. In terms of the government, look, we've said really clearly that this is a high priority for us. And it was something that Angela Rayner, when she was previously in the role, talked about very passionately. And now Steve Reid, who is the new Secretary of State for Housing, is putting a lot of energy behind, because we have to get this right. The housing crisis in this country has been, you know, it's been growing for decades. And I'm not sitting here to point the blade finger at any particular government, but it has been a growing problem for decades. And I've worked in homelessness charities, and I've worked around the sector, as I've already said, for a number of years, and I've seen it from different angles. Now, there's not, there isn't a magic answer to all of this. There's got to be a different type, you know, an approach that takes on lots of different methods in some ways. But one of those is how we look at our planning laws and whether they're doing the right thing. And that's something the government have very clearly done. There has to be a focus on social and affordable housing. We have to be really clear that we cannot just continue to deliver homes which are completely out of reach or too expensive for people to be able to afford. We've got to tackle the crisis in temporary accommodation as well, which is where we've got huge challenges. And we've got to look at homelessness in all its faces as well. So there's lots of intervention that the government are doing at the minute. The Planning and Infrastructure Bill goes into quite a bit of detail around that. We've also put record number of investment into affordable homes, into delivery of affordable homes, but also into tackling homelessness. Street homelessness and rough sleeping and also other forms of homelessness. Now, it's not going to fix everything, but the political drive to fix the housing crisis is something that I haven't felt so strongly for a government for a long, long time.
You mentioned in your answer there a couple of times sort of a magic answer, and things aren't going to be fixed overnight and this sort of thing. But of course, I mean, I'm sure all of our listeners know, and you appreciate, there are some people in politics at the moment who say they have the magic answer and will, you know, make bold statements about how they're going to sort things out. At the moment, the government is quite unpopular. The polls suggest that basically reform are way ahead and all this sort of thing. Lucy Powell, who's just been elected as your new deputy leader, sort of seems to suggest that the Prime Minister needs to change direction or change priorities of what needs to be fixed first. Is she right? Does the Prime Minister need to change direction?
I think that being in government is challenging. And it's also, when we first got elected, the scale of what we've inherited in terms of the challenges that this country is facing are deep and they're embedded. And they're widespread. You know, everything that, when it comes to our public services, when it comes to the economy, everything was in such a difficult situation. And this is not to say that we haven't also necessarily not got everything right in our first years in a government. I think there's been some things that we could have done differently. But in terms of what we're trying to do, in terms of the Prime Minister's priorities around creating a strong and stable economy that people feel they actually have a part of, that they feel that, you know, the future of this country can be better and that their children can have a better life than them, which should be the fundamental principle of any Labour government, it is absolutely what is driving the Prime Minister. And there's been some big pieces of legislation that have marked that, the Employment Rights Bill, the Renters' Rights Bill, which we passed this week, and that's going to have a huge impact in my constituency. The second bit of that is obviously the big global challenges we're now facing as a country, and our national security has to be of utmost importance as well. And that's something that the Prime Minister has been incredibly strong on in terms of the conversations he's having on the global stage, but also how he's been able to reframe the UK as a sensible and strong partner for lots and lots of different countries, the number of trade deals he's been able to manage. Now, what we need to do, though, and I do take this point, is ensure that people feel that difference. And I recognise that that's a challenge. You know, you cannot fix things overnight. And when you have something that we inherited, everything so chronically underinvested in, so many big challenges, I get it. It's hard to see that change quickly. It's hard to deliver that change quickly. But I also recognise that people do need to see some of that. They need to see some of those green shoots. They need to feel that things are getting better. And that's our job, to make sure we get that message across. I'm hoping that with some of the legislation that we've recently passed, with some of the move that, you know, the direction of travel that we're taking to try and fix the foundations of this country, that people will see that very, very quickly. The easy answer to this is to blame other people and to say there are quick fixes. And honestly, we're in a dangerous space if we think that that's to resolve the big problems that we have in this country overnight.
I mean, I think plenty of people listening to this, entirely sort of average, well-mannered people, will listen to what you're saying and understand what you're saying in terms of, you know, it's going to take time, there's not a magic answer and all that sort of thing. But it does feel within the country there is sort of a raising of the political temperature, and some, you know, we've seen protests and the Operation Raise the Colours, as it's called, of people putting up flags, and we can debate, or people do debate rather, the sort of intention behind that. But there does seem to be a growing sort of aggressive rhetoric from certain sections of extremes. I mean, is this something that you personally have experienced and on the doorstep, or do you feel that raised political temperature?
I think it's very hard to ignore the raised political temperature. The one thing I will say is that when I go out in my constituency, I meet lovely people, we have good conversations, and even if people disagree with me, which of course happens all the time, we do that, you know, very sensibly, very politely, and in a way that I feel represents what this country is about, to be able to have that discourse and that discussion. However, all of that said, it is really difficult to not see and be concerned about some of the rhetoric that we are seeing now. And you know, I think that rhetoric is getting emboldened, and it is becoming more mainstream. So I'm a British Asian, I'm a Muslim, I was born in Chatham, I've lived in Gillingham my whole life. I very much see myself as British. I see this country as, you know, who I am, what I am. For me, this is my identity. But that, I now feel, is being questioned in a very real way. And we do have to decide at some point in our future what type of country we want to be. And I have seen, certainly on social media, I can show you how much abuse I receive. And some of the languages, you know, the racism, being called the P word, being said, told, you're not white, so you can never be British. Some incredibly misogynistic comments. I receive those on a daily basis on my social media. And I often share them because I think it's important to show what people are saying out there. What I'm now seeing, though, as well, is some of that language is being emboldened by mainstream politicians. And look, I want to be clear. I think there is a space in which we should be able to have a sensible debate and conversation about immigration, because I think it's fair to say that we all want to ensure that immigration is managed in this country the right way. The numbers have been going up, and I think it has got to a level that we hadn't seen before. That's not under this government, but it is something that's been a trend for quite some time now. And I think we have to be honest that some of that is to do with Brexit, where the Boris Johnson felt that to make up for some of the roles that were lost under freedom of movement, that we would then increase the number of visas to other countries. There's also, of course, that we see the boat crossings. There's lots of things that have created the space we are. And we need to be having a sensible conversation about immigration, and we should be able to have a fair and sensible system in place in this country that manages that. And we've got to look at that seriously. I don't for a minute deny that. But what I do worry about is where this debate has seeped into something that is more about race and identity. And when you see some of the language, so for example, this week we had Sarah Pochin, the Reform MP for Runcorn, saying that it makes her mad to see black and brown faces on television. We then had Robert Jenrick, who had made similar comments around when he was walking around in Birmingham about integration and seeing black and brown faces. And then we had Katie Lamb, the MP for the Weald, saying this week that she thinks that families who are legally settled here might be considered for deportation if it worked better for cultural cohesion. Now, that's a really different conversation. And that's what we've started to kind of seep into. And that has entered on mainstream politics. That is then emboldening some of these conversations that we're seeing in our country and in our communities, which are telling us that you've got to pick a side, that you've got to hate your neighbour. This country has never been about that. And it really worries me that we started to go down this route and start to see some of the racism that I never experienced, lucky growing up. But I certainly heard from my parents' generation and my uncles that they perhaps saw in the 80s. So, you know, I do think we've got to start calling this out. And I think we've got to start thinking really, really carefully about the direction of travel we're taking.
Mm. I mean, those you mentioned Sarah Poachin, you mentioned Robert Jenrick, and Katie Lamb. These are your MP, Parliament colleagues. Do you speak to them about this? Do you say to them? I mean, Katie Lamb is your fellow Kent MP. There's a sort of a Kent group. Have you challenged her on this and said to her, "Look, that's not acceptable," or you know, asked her why she feels it's appropriate to say that sort of thing?
Look, I haven't had the opportunity to challenge them on this because that just hasn't been presented. I mean, I would like to. I would love to have a conversation with them, but I am unfortunately not sure that it would massively matter if I did, because I feel that, and I don't know if these are views that they agree with or if they're saying them because they think this is how you get political capital, but unfortunately, they think that this is the right space to be in, given the debate in the country, and they're playing to some of the remarks that we've some of the language and the direction of travel that this debate is taking, they are playing into it rather than trying to challenge it and sort of bring it back to a sensible position. And I think that's very, very unfortunate. I don't know why they're doing it. I will happily ask them. I haven't had the opportunity to do so yet. But I do feel it's disappointing that this has now entered our mainstream of politics and it's being emboldened by members of parliament in some cases.
Mm. Yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, in the Sarah Poachin case specifically, the apology was more about sort of the way it was phrased rather than the sentiment behind it and that sort of thing. But so in that sense, I mean, is there a way back? Because it does seem like this sort of language has become normalized. Do you think there's a way back from this? And if so, how can we get there?
I mean, I hope so. I think the key thing is to call it out. And one of the greatest mistakes we could make is to just stay silent, because otherwise it becomes and grows legs of its own. And that's why I was really pleased that when Sarah Poachin made those comments, where Streeting, who was asked about them on television, directly called it out and said those comments are racist and this is not acceptable. And I think we've got to start doing that. I think the longer we spend time sort of saying, well, it's fine because, you know, we do have this issue with immigration and it's okay to have the debate like this, this is where we are softly but surely moving away from the conversation and debate that I thought this country was about. You know, I've always believed that British values are about respect, they're about equality, and they're about tolerance. And we shouldn't want to be anything different to that. Yes, we need to talk about our challenges. I don't for a minute disagree. And yes, I think it is okay to have a conversation around immigration, identity, and actually culture. I think no one's saying that we can't do that. But there is a big, big space between that and where we might end up if we carry on down this route. So we've got to call it out and leaders have to call it out. And I'm really pleased that Keir Starmer set out his own vision on this and how he sees the country and what he believes in his conference speech, because this is really important now for our identity as the United Kingdom.
Absolutely. And so my final question, you've mentioned how you've been made a parliamentary private secretary to the Cabinet Office. Could you just explain sort of what that role will entail and what you're hoping to do with it?
Yes, I'm really pleased to have been made a PPS in the Cabinet Office, which is a really exciting opportunity to kind of be in the heart of government. My role is very much about providing that link between the parliament, what's happening in parliament and parliament itself and MPs, to ministers in terms of shaping the work that they're doing, ensuring that they're sort of reflecting what's happening on the ground and that us as MPs are really kind of ensuring that, you know, what's happening in our communities is being heard and listened at the top of government. So my role is acting as a bit of a link, but it's also giving me a lot of exposure and in terms of my understanding of how central government operates. It's been fascinating to be in that role. I've only been doing it for a few weeks, but thoroughly enjoying it. and hoping that going forward we can really shape something in terms of what the government is doing. It's just, it's great to be a part of that conversation.
Fantastic. Nishaba Khan, thank you so much for your time.
The Under Fire KCC leader, Lyndon Kemkaran, came out fighting this week following a pretty torrid time which saw Reform UK expel several councillors for reasons we heard explained by Nikki earlier. According to her, she says she's done nothing wrong, won't be resigning, and who cares if she used some fruity language, were her exact words. Rob, do you think this kind of quite strident attack is the best form of defence here, or is she just racking up more enemies in doing this?
I think for the general public, I think probably it is kind of the right line to take, in the sense of, I mean, the thing we always hear about Nigel Farage is he doesn't speak like a normal politician. And if Lyndon Kemkaran had come out and sort of given a sort of more of a politician's answer, I don't think she would have really gained much for herself. Whereas she comes out, she says, look, you know, this is the way I talk. I'm business, you know, business first. Who cares if I hurt a couple of people's feelings? The important thing, as she says, is that Kent is a flagship council and everybody's watching Reform, so they've got to do a good job. I think a lot of the public will understand that. Whether they accept that sort of language doesn't cross over into being sort of intimidating or horrible to members of the cabinet is a different thing. But I think in terms of her response, just being plain and saying, like, look, I stand by what I said, I think we'll gain her a lot of credit. In terms of within her own party, I'm less sure. It's hard to tell because obviously lots of the conversations are going on behind closed doors. We don't really know how some of the backbenchers feel about this. Some of them may feel that they want this whole saga to sort of get over and done with, and they want it over, whereas others might think, well, I might have hoped that this would shaken Lyndon Kemkaran up to think, well, maybe I should be a bit more careful, be a bit more considerate of my colleagues, and, you know, be a bit more likely to compromise with them and bring them along with me rather than just shouting at them. And I don't think that message really does that. So it's hard to say. If there are more of the second group, I think it may backfire, but it depends how many people are willing to fall in line.
Nikki, what do you think? Were you impressed by her not backing down, or do you think it's the wrong move?
I think you've got to admire her stand and standing by what she feels she's done the right thing. I mean, going back to the language thing, I mean, I'm the last person to criticise over fruity language. I mean, I love the English language and all words in it. And I've been known to F and Jeff here and there, but there is a time and a place. I mean, you shouldn't be directing it at people and a personal thing. I wouldn't dream of using that kind of language in a meeting, and especially directing it to people personally. But, you know, I've got to admire that her stance and saying, you know, she's admitted she's direct, she's forthright and blunt, and she makes no apology for it. And I think, you know, you can go, okay, right, you haven't buckled under pressure, and you've stood by what you've done. And it's kind of like, well, either take it or leave it. I get that. Perhaps not use the same phrase, suck it up, but it does seem like it's a take it or leave it thing. I mean, she's tackled the fallout head on. She's moved fast, and I think she will get a lot of credit for that, like Rob has said, particularly from the public. But how many more within her party are happy to stick with her approach and what has happened so far? I mean, that just remains to be seen.
On topic of language, I do think fruity is a very odd adjective for her to use, but that's neither here nor there. I think you're right to say that it's kind of unclear what effect this will have to people in her party. I think it's probably likely that among Reform KCC members, it will probably just entrench opinions that already exist. The people who are loyal to her and think that she's in the right are going to say, yeah, good on Lyndon, not backing down, sticking it to them and not apologising, all that kind of thing. And the people who are critical of her are going to remain critical of her and say that this shows basically that she's obstinate and stubborn. I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that it kind of makes clear that politics, both inside and outside of parties, isn't just some game of cozy consensus where everybody likes each other and gets along, or at least it certainly shouldn't be. Politics is about conflict and the clash of competing interests and ideas and who wins in those. And I think a lot of the response to this scandal mainly from politicians shows that there are a lot of politicians who are fundamentally uncomfortable with the basis of what politics constitutes, which is a struggle to win and govern, and they're much more comfortable with the idea of consensus, and they have languages which reflect this, which is why other parties have these exact same relationships within them. And yet they, you know, if you recorded a Labour Party meeting and tried to prove some factional beef taking place within it, nobody would be able to understand it. Whereas with Reform, it looks more blatantly like conflict. Whether this will do her any good in their own party, I don't quite know, but I think a slightly unhinged response of other political parties at KCC acting like this is everything falling apart in the Führer bunker, I think will probably continue. All right, that's your lot for this week. Thank you very much to Nikki and Robert for their contributions, and to our special guest this week, Nishaba Khan. Don't forget to keep an eye on Kent Online for the latest politics coverage in the county. And you can also sign up to our politics briefing letter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters. And don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, im-listening.co.uk.